Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As the Memorial Day weekend gets underway, Gilcrease Museum is continuing to feature an artist that has in many ways come to define America, the work of Norman Rockwell. Norman Rockwell, behind the camera, is the first exhibit to explore the artist's working method, which relied on detailed study photographs using everyday people as models. Stephanie Plunkett, the deputy director and chief curator of the Norman Rockwell Museum in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, says Rockwell would often coach his subjects, much like a film director would, in getting the expressions he wanted to capture that would later become iconic images and paintings. The exhibit, which closes in just a couple of weeks on June 10th, continues and features finished paintings from Rockwell, along with magazine illustrations, along with the photographic studies which contributed to the final image. I spoke with Stephanie Plunkett when she was here for the exhibit opening, and she was the guest curator for the exhibit. And we repeat the conversation today here on Studio Tulsa. Stephanie Plunkett, welcome to Tulsa, and welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. I'm really thrilled to be here.
The Gilcrease exhibit devoted to Norman Rockwell does more than just show off the great images of Norman Rockwell that so many of us have come to know and love. It really gives us an inside view of the process. What was the idea behind this exhibit as far as showing off how Rockwell did his process?
We had a really great opportunity to show Rockwell's process because in the museum's archives, and we are fortunate to have Rockwell's papers, was a vast archive of about 50,000 archival negatives that he had created as part of his process. And we were able, with some funding, to actually digitize all those images and really for the first time a few years back, see what really went into the creation of a Rockwell image.
Now, obviously, you're talking negatives. People are saying, wait a minute, he's a painter. No, we're talking photography, right?
Exactly. We are talking photography. Rockwell was an extraordinary draftsman. He was a wonderful painter, great composer. But he was also a very, very busy illustrator. And at the beginning of his career, say at the time of 1916 when he was 22 years old and doing his first post cover, he was bringing live models into his studio and working for hours and hours trying to coax people to maintain the very same poses, the very same expressions. And it was hard because his specialty was children. And you can imagine trying to keep children still. So by about 1929, he figured out that photography could be a great aid to him because he could capture those expressions in a much more detailed way, and he could have maybe a half an hour session as opposed to several hours. And as he became busier and busier, which he did, he had to find ways to save time. But photography wound up being a great creative outlet for him as well.
Yeah, he approached it very much like a film director, right? And he never took photographs himself. I think there's only maybe a few examples of a situation where he actually took a photo himself, and I think those were self-portraits, if I'm remembering correctly.
You are exactly right.
So he hired photographers to do this. So he was like a film director saying, okay, and he's literally instructing his subjects to act.
He certainly was, and not only was he instructing his subjects, he went out and found them. So many illustrators of his time period were using professional models, and he was not. He loved everyone's idiosyncrasies, just the average American, whoever that might be. You know, his neighbors, his friends, his family all posed for him, and he would always have a studio assistant, somebody who worked with him extensively, stretching canvases, taking photographs, finding models, props, costumes. And those were the people who actually were his photographers. I think maybe just one of them was actually a professional photographer. And the rest of them were kind of people who stepped in to help him in a variety of ways.
If I remember right, one was a fellow illustrator.
Exactly. Rockwell lived in Arlington, Vermont for 13 years, and there he came upon Gene Pelham, who was a great actor himself, appeared in a lot of Rockwell pictures, but also was an extremely devoted assistant and then wound up taking lots of photographs. But he was a published illustrator and did a couple of covers for the Post.
Now, one of the interesting parts of this exhibit is People are probably familiar with a couple of covers that he did, which was A Day in the Life of a Young Girl, Day in the Life of a Small Boy or a Young Boy, in which it was a number of illustrations that would be a part of this cover that started from the child waking up in the morning and saying their prayers and going to bed at night. And there's some really remarkable pictures that are part of this photographic archive, which not only show the model of the child doing the various expressions, but there are a couple of images which show Rockwell in the act of directing the child in their expressions.
Exactly. And he was quite a pleasant taskmaster, but he was looking for exactly what he was looking for. So the piece that you're talking about, Day in the Life of a Little Girl, is a little bit like a comic strip because each of the vignettes moves you through her life from morning to night. And Mary Whalen, who's pictured there, was his favorite model. She was a Vermont girl, about 12 years old. She might have been a little younger at that time. And he loved her because she could raise her eyebrows very high. She paid attention to the kinds of expressions he was looking for. And the way that he worked was he would coax and coax and coax, and then he'd see what he wanted, and he'd yell to his photographer, "Get it." And that was the moment when the shutter clicked, and he had what he wanted.
But in the case of this, when you actually see him in the act of coaching the girl through her expressions, what's also interesting is he's basically working in a studio with a bare backdrop behind them.
Exactly.
And so all the details are filled in. All he's wanting to do is get the facial expression. And I think it's mainly the facial expression, even the body motion. I guess he was worried. He did spend a lot of time on that as well, but primarily the facial expression.
Yes, very much so. I mean, he was really all about expression. His paintings focus on people, and I think that's what we love about them. You know, we love to look at other people, and he just had a way of capturing the light behind the eyes, which was like no other illustrator in a way, though there were many, many accomplished illustrators. So I think that's what he was looking for, that sense of life in the expression. And, you know, he understood that that is what we engage with, too, when we look at somebody.
Now tell us some of the tricks that he would use with these everyday people. These would be his neighbors, family members, acquaintances, anybody that he took a shine to. Basically, he would bring them into the studio to put in his illustrations.
Exactly. He did have some tricks. Well, for one thing, he would explain the story that he was trying to tell. And if he was working with a child, he'd explain the story to their parents. And then he would actually take on the expressions that he was trying to get them to take on. And I think, you know, in that way, he was very successful. He always gave children a Coca-Cola, which they looked forward to. And he always paid his models. He paid all of his models by check. And, you know, many people have told us they wish they hadn't cashed that check, but they did. So he understood that his models were central to his work. And, you know, I think he developed a technique of working with them.
I was struck by one of the photographs, again, from the Day in the Life of a Small Girl, in which she's, I guess, supposed to be riding a bicycle, I assume. And so an assistant is holding her pigtail out. Oftentimes they would pin up coat trousers or things like that, or the end of coats, to give the impression of wind, again, to get this sense, to depict walking. Tell us what he would do there.
Oh, it's so funny. He had books on the floor, and he would prop people's feet up in various positions. Now, of course, we know that when we see somebody walking, we really don't see the bottom of the sole of their shoe. But, of course, he's an illustrator, so it's a little bit like theater. You know, you have to make it even a little more than what it actually is. And, I mean, I think one of the things that, to me, is so interesting is people believed in these constructed realities that he made. They suspended disbelief. This is a real scene. These are real people. But he was a very careful orchestrator of every single detail in his paintings. I really think of him as a thinking painter. You know, there was never anything in Rockwell that actually was not there for very good reason. Either it had a narrative component, you know, or it emphasized some point that he wanted to make.
You mentioned you had negatives as opposed to real photographs. So the photographs were disposable quantities once he was finished with the illustration. So how would he actually use the photograph in creating a finished work?
What he would have his assistant do is print out about 100 photographs in 8x10 black and whites, and then he would lay them all out, and he would pick and choose. You know, he'd say, this hand is great, this expression is perfect, this side of the setup or room is just exactly what we're looking for. And then he would put them together in a final drawing that was about the same size as his final paintings. And this would not be a sketch. This was a really detailed charcoal drawing based upon the photographs that had been taken. And that would establish his complete composition, but also, you know, areas of dark and light, all the fine detail that he would want to put into something that would be found in the drawing that was based upon this conglomeration of photographs.
So it sounds like his process was pretty laborious. And I know from just reading what I saw in the exhibit, he was pretty loath to say fini as far as the final oil painting. He was a tinkerer. He wanted to keep messing with things. That sounds the opposite of what you would expect an illustrator's sort of mentality would be.
Well, you know, I think Rockwell did so much more than was required, even at the highest standards of his profession. He was the true perfectionist. You know, I think he almost was never ready to let something go. And there were times when his assistants, like, literally had to rip something away from him. You know, he worked very long hours and sometimes to great frustration. We know we have a story of him throwing a painting out into the snow. He was so disgusted with it. And, you know, this would go on. This was year after year for 7 decades.
Is that out of the norm for most illustrators of his time?
Well, I mean, I think the field of illustration was quite extraordinary at the time because they were creating images for mass circulation. So people never had to leave their living rooms. They didn't have to go to museums or galleries to see works of art. They came into the home. And illustrators did keep image reference files, but normally they were files and files of folders filled with 1950s cars or modern chairs or, you know, saddle shoes. So they were using reprocessed images to create their work, and some were taking photographs too. But no one really to the level that Norman Rockwell was doing this that I can think of.
I'm thinking of one of the pieces that's in the show, Boy in Dining Car, which shows a boy calculating the tip after eating in the dining car with an elderly African-American waiter. And you would expect that to be sort of, okay, he uses pictures, but he actually had to go to a dining, he wanted actually to go to a dining car to get this look exactly right.
Yes, that was an amazing story. He asked to have a dining car sidelined by the New York Central Railway so that he could come in with his son Peter, who's, you know, seen there. He interviewed about 5 different dining car waiters, and he ultimately settled on the gentleman that you see, who has this very warm, fatherly expression, which is what he was looking for. The first car they gave him, he was not happy with. It was the 20th Century Limited, which was their new train, and he felt it was too modern. So they were very disappointed when he actually asked to have an older model sidelined, again, coming from Albany to New York City, which he was very happy with. But if you look closely at the painting, there's a little postcard right in the center of the 20th Century Limited. And the Saturday Evening Post claimed that that was about $10,000 worth of advertising.
This gives you a sense of his popularity at the time. I mean, the idea the railway would go to the trouble of putting a car on the side. This is not the right one. Okay, get the right one.
Absolutely. One of the things we cannot connect to today is the notion that illustrators were celebrities. He was so well known to his public. He actually judged 3 Miss America contests, as did other illustrators in the 20s. So, you know, everyone was reading magazines in the early and mid 20th century. That's how we received information, and entertainment.
Of course, he was fond of putting himself in the margins of many of the illustrations as well, just as a bystander a lot of times.
That's right. He was a little bit like Alfred Hitchcock that way. He made cameos in his own work, and so people got to know what he looked like.
That particular piece and the preparatory pieces that are part of it, along with a very famous image of the runaway, gives you a sense of, even when he thought he had the right people, if it turns out he didn't have the right people, he would go out and find the right people for an illustration. You talked about the number of waiters that he went through to find the right one. In the case of the runaway, this is a very famous image of a Massachusetts state trooper sitting next to a little boy with his knapsack in front of a soda stand, and he's looking over at the runaway, and the man behind the counter is also looking. And when you actually look at the preparatory work, originally it was like a young soda jerk, and he decided to change that.
Exactly. One of the things that he was always ready to do was to start over. And in the case of that runaway painting, he realized that the young soda jerk would not necessarily convey the kind of empathy or worldliness that an older counterman might. So he not only changed out the character, but he completely stripped away the background to create a diner that looked like a rural eating place. And he said he wanted to give more of the sense that the boy had gotten farther away from home.
Now, I was doing the math on how many Saturday Evening Posts that he did. You know, I kind of think of him as being almost ubiquitous on the Saturday Evening Post, but he did a tremendous number, 320-something mm-hmm. covers. But over the course of his career, that was only about 8 to 10 a year.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
And I think that was kind of surprising. I assumed that it would be a lot more per year.
Yes, it's so interesting. I mean, I think he, in a lot of ways, created a sense of what the Post was, and the Post created him too. But he did between 8 and maybe 12 covers a year. And they generally had a stable of other illustrators, maybe 6 to 10, who were doing wonderful work. But Rockwell is really the one who was remembered. And the Post claimed that every time he did a cover, they sold an additional 75,000 copies.
Wow.
On the newsstand, yeah.
That's a measurable, marketable total right there.
Exactly.
Yeah. My guest today is Stephanie Plunkett, the chief curator at the Norman Rockwell Museum in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. The Gilchrist Museum is presenting Norman Rockwell Behind the Camera, which shows how the illustrator worked to create his iconic images. It's on display through June 10th. There are a number of Saturday Evening Post covers, as well as original art, and a number of these preparatory photographs. And what's really interesting, I think, about the exhibit is just the exhaustive nature of his preparatory work. And I think there's no better example in one of his strongest images I think he ever created, and that's the problem we all live with. This was not a Saturday Evening Post. So I don't think the Saturday Evening Post would ever put something like that on the cover. It was actually for Look magazine after he severed his ties with the Saturday Evening Post, and it was the first work he did for Look magazine. Tell us about this very iconic image.
Absolutely. It is actually one of Rockwell's best known and most important. In 1963, Rockwell decided to leave the Post. There were challenges there, I think, for him. He was being asked to do a lot more political portraiture, which he was certainly competent at, but he loved the idea of narrative storytelling. And he was also at a stage in his career where he was kind of an elder statesman. I think he understood that as a marketable, popular illustrator, he could have a voice and maybe make some statements that might be influential in society. So he did, as you say, go to Look magazine, which was equally popular in terms of its circulation, but focused more on contemporary events. And they asked him to create an image that was commemorating the 10th anniversary of the Brown versus Board of Education ruling that basically said that separate is not equal in America's public schools. And he chose a moment that occurred in 1960 with a young girl, 6 years old, named Ruby Bridges. And she was the first to integrate the New Orleans public school system. So, of course, what he focuses on in this image is are not the people who were boycotting the school because Ruby was about to enter.
Not the protesters.
Not the protesters, exactly. But the young girl herself, you know, the innocence, the determination, you know, this clarity of that march that she took into school literally every day for a year, surrounded by four U.S. Marshals.
And the image itself is really striking because we don't actually see the Marshals' faces. We see them literally from their shoulder with the shoulder patch that says they are a federal marshal down, two in front, two behind. And what the preparatory studies shows, the exhaustive nature of what he was trying to do. The backdrop is this wall in which an epitaph has been scrubbed, almost tried to be erased from the wall, but it's still visible. And there is a tomato thrown against that word on the wall. And in the preparatory studies, you see he wanted to see how a tomato splattered. And so he splattered against his backdrop in his studio. He photographed a number of walls to get the right wall. He photographed a number of girls to get the right girl. And it's really powerful the extent he was going to get this image that we all remember today.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In fact, the three girls that he photographed were part of the same family, the Gunn family in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. He went to a local seamstress and asked her to make the identical white dress in three different sizes so that he could photograph each girl to see which one would be best for his picture. So yes, the extent is quite extraordinary.
And I assume that time at Look magazine became very liberating for him because he was more of a progressive and the Saturday Evening Post was pretty conservative. I think in some of these Look images, you're actually to see his sort of own view on narrative storytelling.
Yes, the Post was a conservative magazine. It had a little bit of something for everybody, but they tended not to take political stands, certainly on the covers. In fact, there was a kind of an unwritten rule that said that if you were to portray someone of color, it would have to be in a service industry role. So that was frustrating for Rockwell, and I think for many other illustrators who tried to find certain ways of subverting that regulation. But Look magazine, as you say, was quite liberating in that way, and I think he was able to express some of the things he truly felt.
The other example from that same time period is New Kids in the Neighborhood, which was a very different take on how America was dealing with this problem we all live with, as the name of the first illustration was. And this was suburban issues. This particular piece is something that it's almost like a Where's Waldo effect in a lot of his illustrations. You know, in this case, it is an African-American family moving into a white neighborhood. The kids are looking at each other. They're very much the same in so many ways, but different in other ways. And it's beautiful what he does. Can you maybe describe some of the little subtleties of this particular image?
Absolutely. You know, New Kids in the Neighborhood was a story illustration in the sense that it ran alongside an article that talked about the integration of suburbs outside of Chicago. So what his image did was humanize this very statistical text. As you say, I mean, he actually has two families of children encountering each other. And, you know, we see in their body language that they are skeptical, but perhaps willing to come together. And we see they have common interests. You know, the boys both have baseball gloves. They wear sneakers. Both families have pets. So he's trying to show us that, of course, as children, as humans, they have a lot in common.
But
and there's a very telling element that in the background, if you look very carefully, there's a window with a curtain parted. And we see that there's somebody peering out, most likely an adult. And we definitely get the sense that the children may fare a little better than the adults.
Yeah. It's a very striking small detail. How common was that in his illustrations?
Rockwell thought everything through down to the finest detail. And there are many examples of him using a detail to give great depth to something that he was working on.
Tell us about some of the standout images. We've talked about a few of them, but what in your mind are the real standout images visitors should really spend some time with?
Absolutely. Well, you know, there's one piece on view that I would call one of Rockwell's masterpieces, and that is a piece called Art Critic. It's really a beautiful painting, but it exhibits this great sense of humor that Norman Rockwell had. I mean, I think humor was a really important element of his work throughout his career. And of course, there's a lot in Rockwell's art that's autobiographical. So this portrays Rockwell's own son, Jarvis, his oldest son, who was at the time a student at the Boston Museum School, an art school, art student. And he is peering really closely, a little too closely, to a portrait that was based upon his own mother, Mary. And then in Rockwell's very humorous fashion, he has another painting group of Dutch masters looking on very disapprovingly at the fact that this young man is getting a little too close.
Yeah, he's getting very close, looking at her décollage, if you will.
Yes.
Peering at it very closely, and you can see that he's got an easel. And in the finished painting, you can see that the paints on the easel are actually three-dimensional because he's just put a huge dollop of paint on the easel. But the Dutch masters are, instead of their eyes looking where you would expect the picture to look, because they're a picture on the wall, they're actually looking over the boy looking at the subject in the picture. It's very, very humorous.
Yeah. It really is. It's a great example of Rockwell's editing because his first version had a serene 17th century Dutch landscape in place of the masters. But he, of course, realized that he wouldn't get the bang for his buck there, you know, that this would be a much more lively, humorous solution. And there's a really fun picture on the wall nearby of Rockwell's wife, Mary. And she was, as I said, the model for the image in the portrait, also inspired by Rubens. But she's wearing around her neck diaper cloth, which is meant to look like a kind of a cloak.
Uh-huh.
And he had lots of diaper cloth in the studio because that's what he cleaned his brushes with.
Mm, interesting.
Yeah.
You know, as you well know, and I think this is probably a problem for your museum now, is that Norman Rockwell paintings are highly collectible. I mean, we're talking tens of millions of dollars. I think there is a cover in the show that recently sold at auction for something like $30 million. What do you attribute this popularity to now? Because, you know, Rockwell was sort of considered old-fashioned and out of fashion for a while. Why do you suppose he's so fashionable now?
I guess what I would say is we, as the Norman Rockwell Museum, have, through the years, been trying to bring Rockwell to greater attention, to inspire discussion of his work, to invite people to consider what impact of Rockwell imagery has had on us as a nation, you know, how we think about ourselves, what we aspire to. And I think there has thankfully become, there's a climate now where there's more openness to viewing different kinds of art and considering its significance. So, you know, for many years, the thought was that illustration was a lesser art. And I think now that is actually beginning to change. So Rockwell, of course, being the greatest American illustrator of the 20th century, is sort of at the center of this vortex. And yes, you're right. That has actually caused his market prices to soar.
So no more buying Norman Rockwell's on the cheap for the museum.
Oh, boy. I only wish that we could. But unfortunately, he is out of our price range. We have received some wonderful donations, however.
Well, you can see some of Rockwell's work at the Gilcrease Museum on display through June 10th. Stephanie, thanks for joining
us. Thank you so much.
Stephanie Plunkett is the Deputy Director and Chief Curator of the Norman Rockwell Museum. I spoke with her back in February when the exhibit Norman Rockwell Behind the Camera first opened at Gilcrease Museum. The exhibit's in its final 2 weeks. It closes June 10th, and of course, Gilcrease Museum will be open both Saturday and Sunday of the holiday weekend. For more information on the exhibit, visit gilcrease.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.